That cool beat of Clouds Below Your Knees by Ray Lynch signals 8 p.m. Thursday, and time for So What's Your Story, the only program originating in Houston devoted entirely to storytelling, right here on listener-sponsored KPFT 90.1 FM. I'm your host, Greg Audell, and alongside a team drenched, absolutely drenched in talent, Drs. Hank Rubicek, Warren Holloman, Mary Edgerton, and our masterful media maven and engineer, Tatiana Gago, and of course, as always when I'm here, Floyd the Wonder Dog. We celebrate the power of story by placing the spotlight on tellers who take us on journeys through windows of their souls before safely and generally gently back to the present. Tonight, we're fortunate to have two wonderful storytellers with us. Ginger Burney is a native Houstonian who's worked as curator of collections at Houston's Heritage Society since 2002. She has a bachelor's degree in history and a master's degree in public history. Like me, she's passionate about telling Houston's stories. She is responsible for interpretations at the Heritage Society's 10 historic buildings at Sam Houston Park. That is amazing. That is amazing. They range from the earliest old place built in 1823 to the most modern of homes built in 1905. I'd be interested to learn about the differences in those homes. As a Houston history buff, I'm extraordinarily envious of all the information and stories that Ginger has, and I appreciate that she's willing to share some of them with us tonight. And Eric Huffman is an author who serves as the lead pastor of a church called The Story Houston. You know we're going to like that name. Eric's passion is to inspire a new generation of non-religious people to consider making Jesus the focal point of their life. Since January 2018, Eric has produced and hosted the Maybe God podcast. I love that name. Thanks. In which he wrestles with many of the questions skeptics, agnostics, and atheists are asking. I think most of us have probably fit in most of those categories at some point in our life.
Absolutely.
Maybe God currently averages 2,500 downloads per episode. That's very impressive. But most importantly, Eric is a championship caliber Little League baseball coach. That is an awesome job. Who consistently throttles his children at their favorite video games. I'd like to hear their take on it. He and Giovanna, his wife, live in Montrose with their two kids, Zyra and Cohen.
Nailed it.
All right. Ginger and Eric, welcome to So What's Your Story? I am really stoked to have y'all here tonight.
Thank you.
Thanks. It's great to be here.
Last night, Eric's church hosted a fantastic story night, and I was proud to be there with three other Moth winners, Alyssa Ladd, Amanda Dayton, and Brenna Dalvivia. And they've all been guests on this show, I am proud to say, along with six tellers from his church. There was a huge turnout. I met a lot of nice folks and discovered just some fantastic new storytellers. That's what I love about going to events. It's nice to see my friends, you know, who are sort of part of the storytelling circuit, but I love seeing that spark, you know, when someone tells a great story the first time and they realize they can do it.
It really was amazing. It was the first time I'd ever been a part of an event like that.
Well, I include you in that because you told a story.
I did tell a story. I did not get any winning votes, however. Total of zero votes for me. But we had some incredibly talented storytellers. Brenda Valdivia won and took home the grand prize.
She owns the stage.
She does.
Yeah, and Hank and I were talking about that earlier. She's a former student of Hank's.
Yeah.
And she is just, you know, commanding on stage.
She's tremendous. And Spindletap Brewery, local brewery here in Houston, sponsored it and hooked us up.
That helped grease the wheels a little.
We had a great time.
But anyway, congratulations. And it was a first-time event. And, you know, as someone who's produced events through my life, I know that's not the easiest thing.
Thank you.
You know, one of my great frustrations is that while Houstonians tend to be very proud of our amazing city, most know virtually nothing about its history. I mean, thousands upon thousands of people drive on Allen Parkway every single day, yet they can tell you next to nothing about John, Augustus, and Charlotte Allen. You know, everyone's proud to have one of the nation's finest universities smack dab in the middle of our town, but how many can tell you anything about its founder and namesake, William Marsh Rice? You know, Ginger, your first story will help us learn a little bit more about Mr. Rice's life and his untimely death. Let's hear it.
Sure. It's It's a fantastic story. I am not a professional storyteller per se, as much as a curator and a giver of tours.
Sounds like a storyteller to me.
Yes, I do. I do tell people this story fairly regularly. So I'll try to make it interesting for you. Although this story doesn't need any embellishment. It begins with William Marsh Rice. He is born in Massachusetts, and he comes to the newly established state country of Texas. He comes to Houston in about 1839. Like many people at that time, he was looking to make his fortune. And boy, did he ever. Something many people don't know about Texas at that time is they did not allow banking. There were no formal banks. Therefore, there were no formal money lenders. People like William Marsh Rice, who began with not much money. He was really a self-made man. He opened his own business, began selling merchandise, became a cotton factor. He imported cotton and sold it and made a lot of money. And he also lent money to people. He filled that void of banking. And people would also put up their own property as collateral. And if they were not able to pay him back, he got their property. That's how he amassed a lot of these businesses and this money that he had. Eventually, he grew to be the wealthiest man in Houston. That's amazing. And we move forward a little to 1850. He gets married to a woman, Margaret, and they're doing very well. They buy a home from his business partner, Ebenezer Nichols, and they move in. They set up life. Things are going well. They don't have any children, and not long after the Civil War begins, he doesn't let that really slow his business down. He actually, his first wife died during the Civil War, 1862, and he moves to Mexico, takes his business there. He starts shipping cotton in his roundabout manner through Mexico and out to Europe, continuing to make a lot of money. Once the war is over, he comes back to Houston, and he gets another wife. In 1867, he marries Elizabeth, and again, they are happy, doing well. However, they are not so enamored with Houston, and she encourages them to move to New Jersey. And New York, they travel a bit, but they do settle in New Jersey. However, he has a lot of businesses still in Houston, obviously. And he comes back to Houston very frequently. Her health is also not very good, so they don't want to winter in New Jersey. So they come back to Houston frequently. Then, as I said, her health is not that great. However, they also don't have any children. So Rice is deciding what to do with his amassed fortune. And he wants to open a school. Initially, he wants to open it in New Jersey. And he begins thinking about that and how he can establish it. And then on another trip down to Houston, a man by the name of Lombardi meets with him to talk about opening a school here in Houston. It's still kind of his home, and wouldn't it be a great place? And he eventually does agree. In the meantime, as I said, his wife is ill, and she has a stroke and is sick for a little while. And during that time, a man named Orrin T. Holt meets with Elizabeth Rice sort of secretly with her family, and they draw up a new will. Don't tell William about it, and they make her a resident of Texas. And in doing so, under Texas community property law, she would be allowed to have half of his assets. And again, like I said, she didn't tell him this. And she passes away. And then the will becomes known. William is not happy about this, as you can imagine. Then he fights this as the will is admitted to probate. He files suit against Holt, who strangely becomes mayor of Houston later, by the way.
Wow.
Yeah. And then William claims that he's a resident of New York and they do not have community property laws. So he's fighting this. in this dispute, Holt hires a lawyer by the name of Albert T. Patrick to take testimony in the case. And in doing so, Patrick learns about Rice's fortune. And he also learns that it's supposed to establish an institute in Houston. And he learns how much money is at stake here. In the meantime, William Marsh Rice has hired a butler, a manservant by the name of Charlie Jones, he's older by this time, so he needs help taking care of his personal business, and Charlie Jones fills that role. Well, Albert Patrick approaches Charlie Jones and convinces him to draw up a secret will again, this one completely fake, to where all of Rice's fortune would instead be left to Patrick. Jones goes along with this. He learns to forge Rice's signature pretty well. So they have made this fake will with supposed witnesses. And we're talking about a lot of money here. And then they realize they need to, of course, kill William Marsh Rice. So they get some mercury pills, and Patrick instructs Jones to put them in Rice's food and drink to kill him, and it doesn't work. And then something happens. The hurricane hits Galveston, the 1900 hurricane. This all ties together. The 1900 hurricane hits Galveston. It's terribly severe, and it destroys several businesses owned by Rice. And he decides he's going to repair them. This is going to cost a couple $100,000. And Patrick sees his fortune disappearing. And he decides they have to get a little more determined in their murder. And he instructs Jones to chloroform Rice. And so one night, Jones does this. Now, again, Rice is an older man, so at first they think that he has died of natural causes. Again, this is in 1900. However, Patrick just can't wait to get his hands on that money. Even though he's made this fake will, he's got it all set up. He can't wait. He tells Jones to write a check and forge a signature immediately from Rice, forged, to Patrick for a large sum of money. However, Jones makes a critical error. He accidentally misspells Patrick's name. This alerts the folks at the bank, and they think something is fishy. So they call to check, only to find out that Rice is, in fact, dead. So again, extremely fishy. So they call James Baker, who is Rice's lawyer here in Houston, and tell him that something is very fishy. So Baker quickly steps in, halts the cremation, and because Baker was in on all of the plans to establish Rice. So he knows what is supposed to happen with that money. So he sees the very suspicious Patrick and Jones and alerts the police. They stop the cremation and they instead investigate. And pretty quickly, Jones confesses and turns in Patrick.
Wow.
It's a very sensational crime story with lots and lots and lots of newspaper stories that were published in New York and here in Houston. And so this is really how James Baker steps in to solve the murder of his friend and client and allows Rice Institute to continue as William Marsh Rice wanted it to be set up.
What an amazing story. on so many levels. Now, my first question may sound silly, but I'm serious.
Okay.
Is this where the origin of the phrase "the butler did it" came from?
I've used that phrase for sure. That's what people say.
I mean,
he did.
Sensational trial.
Oh, it was huge. You know, at Rice University, they have several ledgers with all of the news stories covering it. I mean, this was the OJ trial of 1900. It was extremely sensational. And, you know, they were found guilty, thankfully, and they sold, you know, all of Rice's possessions as he wanted. Had
wow.
to pay off Holt and a few other folks along the way. But as we all know, as Houstonians, we have our wonderful Rice Institute.
With the James A. Baker Institute
exactly.
as part of Rice.
Exactly.
I never made that connection before, that it went back that far.
Oh, yes.
Another interesting thing, I was out at Glenwood Cemetery recently. I wanted to see where Charlotte Allen was buried. And interestingly, James Baker is very close to where she's buried. And then the Botts family
yes.
are connected. I don't know if they were intermarried or just friends that considered each other family, but, you know, Charlotte Allen, James Baker, and the Botts family are all right there.
Yes.
If you haven't been to Glenwood Cemetery, right off Washington, it's an amazing step back into Houston's history.
It really is. It's a treasure. I love just driving around in it. And since you brought that up, I'll let you know one little factoid. Maybe you don't know where William Marsh Rice's remains are.
No. Is it Glenwood?
No.
Where is it?
He was cremated, and his ashes are in the base of his statue at Rice University.
I did not know that. I'm amazed
yeah.
that some industrious Rice, you know, college group hasn't figured out how to get them out of there with all the pranks they pull.
I don't want to encourage that,
yeah.
but
hey, the cat's out of the bag now.
That's where he is. That's where he is. Yes.
And doesn't the Heritage Society have William Marsh Rice's house?
Yes, we do. As I mentioned quickly, it was built in 1850 originally by his business partner, Ebenezer Nichols, who quickly moved to Galveston, and William Marsh Rice purchased the home and lived there for the duration of his first marriage.
Well, now I got to get out there and see it.
Oh, it's beautiful. It's spectacular.
I hope you have a long line of our listeners ready to check that out. Well, thank you. And, you know, all the questions are popping up in my head. but that is an amazing story.
Yeah, it is.
And poor Mr. Rice.
I know.
Now, Eric, your first story reminds us that one can become a Houstonian no matter where they started their life. Can you tell us that story?
Yeah, it's one of the great things about our city, I think. So when you asked me to tell a story about this town, I decided to tell a story about a girl. And she was only 5'3". But when she looked out her bedroom window, she always felt like she could see the whole world. 7,000 feet above sea level. Her house stood on a mountainside, overlooking the South American city of Quito, Ecuador. And every morning she looked out across the valley at the commuter planes that were landing and taking off from the airport below. And she wondered about all the people inside of them, the places they'd been, and where they were going. One day, after walking her little sister home from school and feeding her a snack, she stood at that window, and she heard a little voice inside. The voice said, "Go." She was just 14 years old, but she knew that voice so well. and she knew exactly what go meant. Her life to that point had been a struggle. And when she was just 4, her 2-year-old brother died suddenly from a reaction to penicillin. Her mom, who was pregnant at the time with the family's 3rd child, then went into a deep depression that lasted over a decade. And so this little girl, she had to grow up a lot faster than most little girls do. And over the next 10 years, she did more and more of the family's cooking and cleaning. And soon she became her baby sister's primary caregiver, getting her dressed and fed and dropped off at school most days. This little girl's dad, he was a pastor at one of the largest Pentecostal churches in Quito. And even though his little girl's life was a struggle, she always felt a strong connection to God. Her traditional culture, her Pentecostal church, and even her own father all insisted and instilled in her the idea that a girl like her must always be submissive and must always be led by men. But she was convinced that God didn't necessarily see it the same way they did. In fact, deep down, she knew that the last 10 years of leading her family had prepared her for something more. God was calling her to lead the church. But in order to lead, she had to go away from that window, away from that house, away from her family and her church, and away from the only city she'd ever called home. And so a year later, she went to the airport with only 1 suitcase and the $20 bill her grandfather had slipped into her pocket. And before she went through security, her dad looked her in the eyes and he said, "If you get on that plane, you're no longer my daughter." She was crushed. But the only voice in the universe that mattered more than her father's was the one that told her to go. So with tears in her eyes, she went, a 15-year-old child, and she boarded that plane alone. After takeoff, she could see the mountain where her family's home stood through the window. She lowered the plastic shade and closed her eyes, and she prayed until she reached her final destination of Houston, Texas. She found a job here as a youth pastor at a Brazilian church that was meeting somewhere in the West Chase district. And for months, she stayed with the pastor's family, sleeping on their couch in their apartment. They paid her whatever they could, but it wasn't very much. She had no transportation, and she often felt alone and afraid and hungry. But she never lost hope. And she just knew that God had brought her to this place, Houston, Texas, for some reason. The Brazilian church was growing fast, and it needed to find a bigger place to meet on Sunday mornings, and so they struck a deal with the Methodist church up the street on Westheimer, near Westheimer and Gessner, and agreed to use their fellowship hall on Sundays. And the first Sunday they were there, that 15-year-old girl from Ecuador went looking for the restrooms and got lost. And she wandered into the sanctuary by mistake, right in the middle of that preacher's sermon. And as soon as she got over the embarrassment of everybody staring at her, she looked up to the pulpit and saw the reason that God brought her to Houston. The preacher she interrupted was unlike any she'd ever seen before. This preacher was a woman. A woman leading a church. Starting that afternoon, Reverend Martha took that girl under her wing. And within a few months, that girl had a bedroom of her own in Martha's house. And 2 years later, the Methodist church that Martha led provided their Ecuadorian little sister with a full scholarship to go to college. And that's where I met her. And on the first day of our freshman year, we shared our first class. And 4 days later, I wrote in my journal, "I'm going to marry this girl." And I did. She's only 5'3", but I'll always look up to her. And I'll be forever grateful that when God said go, she went to Houston.
Wow. Now, you just did something really unfair. If you wear contact lenses and you get a tear in your eye, it makes it impossible to read your script. That is a beautiful story.
Well, thank you. I love that woman.
I would imagine she's probably pretty fond of you, too.
We have our moments. But
How old are your kids?
My daughter is 11. Our daughter's 11. Our son is 9. And we've been married this June. It'll be 20 years.
And didn't you say did y'all get married at 18 years old?
We met at 18. We got married at 20. We had just turned 20.
Wow. That's amazing.
Yeah. It's been a great 20 years.
And how old are your children? I'm sorry.
They're 11 and 9, so fifth grade and third grade.
Wow.
Yep.
And do they both play baseball?
No, no, just the boy plays baseball. If she wanted to, she totally could, but she's not interested.
Does she go back to Ecuador?
Yes, we go back together once every couple of years. The family kind of pieced it back together and things are good.
I'm lucky to have been there twice, and I think Quito is one of the most beautiful places I have ever been in my life.
It's amazing. It really is gorgeous.
And as much as I love Quito, I love the journey to Quito.
Yes.
You know.
Yeah, through the Andes and everything. It's gorgeous.
Yeah, it's if you ever have a chance to get to Ecuador, start at Quito, not Guayaquil.
Yes, absolutely agree.
This is Greg Audell with Tatiana Gago running the control board. And tonight you are enjoying stories with guest tellers, Pastor Eric Huffman and Ginger Burney, curator of Houston's Heritage Society, on So What's Your Story? 90.1 KPFT Houston, 89.5 in Galveston, and 91.9 in Huntsville. What is happening? Let's talk to the control room for a minute. Hank, are you back there?
I sure am.
What is happening in the world of Houston storytelling?
Well, first of all, Glenn is helping us here, not Tatiana.
I know.
You know, Tatiana, we're so used to saying Tatiana, but we got to really thank Glenn. Thank you very much. Wally told Glenn he ordered him to stay and help us because Tatiana's got this Phi Beta thing going. I don't know why she's so smart, but she does. And, you know, I gave her the night off. She's earning a lot of money.
Well, and if Glenn hadn't been kind enough to stay here for us, you would have heard a very, very quiet hour because I have no idea how to
do it. I know. We're so used to saying Tatiana, but she's not here. Glenn is, and boy, am I glad. You know, there's no question that our program, given its historical placement, is essential to Houston storytelling. After all, we've been around 11 years, which isn't bad for a show when I was first told, can you get a guest every week? You know, so we're coming up on our 500th story. So
500th episode.
Yeah, I mean, I started when I was 26, and here I am pushing 40. I don't know. It's been forever.
Hey, but, you don't tell my secrets, I won't tell yours.
But, you know, H-Town is one of those storied locations. No pun intended, but our sponsor, the Houston Storytellers Guild, is a great place to learn about the art of storytelling. We owe them a great deal for serving as our sponsor. And they have an astonishingly supportive set of members. They meet the fourth Tuesday, and that means this Tuesday, March 26th, and every month from 7 to 8:30 at Temple Emmanuel, located at 1500 Sunset in the library. It's a great setup. We also ask everyone to visit the Guild's website at www.houstonstorytellers.org for information about upcoming events like our favorite one around the corner, the Liars Contest on April 13th. Yours truly is going to be emceeing it. It'll be at Dillon 2 on the campus of Houston Baptist University. And lying on a Baptist campus, it just doesn't get any more fun than that. I got to tell you, if you're the master of the tall tale and you can lie at HBU, I got to tell you, it is more fun than the law allows. So get all the information on the Guild's website. And while you're there, listen to some of our past So What's Your Story programs. Every show since 2008 when we started as an open journal. All listed on the menu under radio program. We got a whole bunch there, so you better get started. And if you don't own a radio, get a life. But still, if you don't have a radio, you can still listen to us stream live on kpft.org and on Facebook Live. And visit us on our So What's Your Story Facebook page. And share it with all of your friends. And we love it if you'd like us on
Please
the way
like
out.
Us.
So What's Your Story is on YouTube as well. We are all over the darn place. Our friends at The Moth as well at Warehouse Live on the second Tuesday of the month is where you'll enjoy some stunning stories and get to know even more of the Houston storytelling community. The next one is Tuesday, April 16th, and the theme is bamboozled. I'm surprised. Are there any millennials who even know that word? I know I just insulted half the population. Nevertheless, did they ever? I mean, it's more than one syllable. Okay.
It's a good question.
I'm just one of those moose, and I know. I got it. Okay. And hey, we also want to hear from you. So if you have any program ideas or comments for anyone on our team, shoot us an email at story@kpf.org. And I promise, absolutely promise, that we're going to get back to you. Thank you, Greg. Back to you.
Wow. Well, we are in for a real treat next week when Warren Holloman hosts Deborah Deep Mouton, the current poet laureate of the city of Houston, and D.F. Brown, author of Ghost of a Person Passing in Front of a Flag, a poetic memoir of the Vietnam War. You will not want to miss this episode, and you won't want to miss any So What's Your Story episode. I promise you, out of those 450 stories online, there's not a bad one in the bunch. There really isn't. I mean, and Hank, the credit goes to you for creating and building this show into what it is. Now, Ginger, the Camp Logan riot of 1917 is another seminal event in Houston's history that shockingly most folks know absolutely nothing about. Will you help at least enlighten those of us who are wise enough to listen to this program and share the Camp Logan story with us?
Absolutely. Absolutely. I really enjoy sharing the entire story of Camp Logan because so many Houstonians, like myself, enjoy going to Memorial Park, and especially on a day like today. And if you ask most people jogging by what is Memorial Park memorializing, they don't know. They just know that's the name of the park. So few people know what went on in that location, and I'm talking about the entirety of it, beginning in 1917, of course, the United States enters World War I. We had reluctantly, or not so much, sort of kept from entering into it, and finally couldn't hold back. And so when we did, the United States was not prepared. Our military was not prepared. We were at a peacetime. And so we had to kick it into gear and get these men trained to go off to fight in France. And the government determined that temporary facilities or camps needed to be established to train the new recruits. They had just recruited a large number of men ready to serve, but they were not trained. In 1917, June 14th, it was announced that Houston had been awarded a campsite for a division of the National Guard. The facility was to be named Camp Logan for Major General Camp Logan. Major General John Logan, a veteran of the Civil War, and congressman who actually in 1868 helped found Memorial Day as a national holiday. He was from Illinois. That's another thing that most folks don't know, is the men who trained and lived at Camp Logan were all from Illinois. The 33rd Infantry Division of soldiers of the Illinois National Guard were supposed to train at Camp Logan, but first they had to establish it. The Hogg family of Ima Hogg had a large amount of land on Buffalo Bayou, west of the city limits, and they leased it to the government, along with other lands the government leased. There was about 3,000 acres. Today, Memorial Park is about half that size, about 1,500 acres. And they went about establishing a training camp, and that meant they had to clear forest, build roads, and set up everything that a training facility that was supposed to house almost 40,000 men had to contain. So you have to have a hospital, tents for soldiers, bakery, mess hall, artillery range, stables, everything necessary for these men to live and train. And they created it out of a forest. The outer areas of the camp had rifle and artillery ranges, drill grounds. They even dug their own trenches to simulate the trench warfare that they would be going into in France. They had a large number of horses, stables. They did have some vehicles. Anyway, they had to build all of this in a matter of months, and they did. And so this is where the part of the story comes in with the riot. It's really two stories, Camp Logan. The riot takes place actually not on the Memorial Park grounds. If you think about it, if you're setting up a camp, you're building a massive site to house these men, it's not ready for the very people who are building it to be living in it, of course. So a regiment of African-American soldiers, again from Illinois, were sent to Houston to guard the construction of Camp Logan. So they were actually living closer to down Washington at Reinerman. And they had been living in Houston for several weeks. And living in Jim Crow Houston was a different experience for some of these men, most of them being from the north. They were harassed by locals. They were forced to do things differently, curfews, not allowed to go many places. And they were agitated. They did not like this. And the police, the Houston police force, was not happy about them being here either. And eventually what sparks things is a member of the soldiers was arrested by the Houston police. And the rumors started flying back at the camp where the men are, where the soldiers are. And the rumor mill gets even wilder to the point where they think his name is Sergeant Baltimore. They think that he's been murdered, and panic sets in. Rumors. You can imagine this intense atmosphere building. The white officers come in and sense this tension, and they order the sergeant to take the guns and munitions and lock them away. But instead, panic sets out. A man shouts, you know, they're coming for us. And they really envision the Houston police and locals coming into their camp and shooting them, arresting them. They don't know what. And then they hear a shot. And again, it's rumor and panic. And they grab the guns and they set out to march to the police station where they're going to enact their revenge. So they march through the streets of Houston, firing at people in their neighborhood homes who come out to see what the commotion is. This is about 100 men marching through the street, marching up West Dallas, going to downtown. And unfortunately, several citizens are just curious and they end up dying. It's a terrible event that goes on for a couple of hours, and eventually the men accidentally shoot one of their own, and they second guess themselves. They fall apart. The mob falls apart, and the city is under martial law basically for a couple of days. The leader of the group ends up shooting himself, taking his own life. There's a little bit of dispute there. Some people think he was shot, but most agree that he shot himself. And it was a very tragic night. Most of the folks who were killed were innocent bystanders, but it created a real atmosphere of panic. And as I said, there was martial law. Thankfully, they loaded up the men pretty much the next day, put them on a train, and got them out of town where they were court-martialed. this was just days from the men coming to Camp Logan, the soldiers who were coming to live and train, and the officers arriving. So you have this madness that ensues, and then they're whisked away, and then the actual soldiers come to live and train there. So you have this sort of complex history at Memorial Park, because then the men do go on to live and train, and the facilities were really extensive, and they do go off to fight in France. Interestingly, an African-American unit does come and train there as well. There was, of course, apprehension about this, but it ended well. Those men went on to fight as well in France. So after the war, in 1919, the government shuts down all of these training camps, of course, and auctions off all of these buildings. And then a couple of citizens put out the call to establish a park. And the Hogg family actually buys up the rest of the land and then sells it to the city at cost. And the city does establish this wonderful park that we enjoy today. And there are archaeologists who I know, Linda Gorski and Louis Albach, who have done wonderful archaeological research and found some remnants of Camp Logan still there.
Wow.
Yeah. And I believe as they are redoing Memorial Park now, you know, they've been doing a lot of work there, they are going to make its history more prominent. So hopefully more folks will know more of the story.
Absolutely. I mean, how tragic it is that so many people spend so much time there and are oblivious to it.
Yes.
I certainly used to be, you know, long ago. What's amazing to me is I drive down West Gray and Memorial several times a week. And it's just incredible to think back in your mind what happened there. I certainly don't think about it when I'm going. Where on West Dallas were they marching?
Yes, I kind of drive along there, too. They started marching and crossed over the bayou in what was called the Brunner edition, the Brunner suburb. And it's at Washington and Shepherd. And they cross over the bayou, and then they come to, it was called San Felipe Road, and it's West Dallas. So they go by Founders Cemetery at that point. They get up to Heiner Street, and that's where a couple of the shootings happened.
I think so, I'm going to have to make this trek this weekend and just kind of keep them in my thoughts.
There's a really good book. I think it's called A Night of Violence that really tells you.
Yes, it is an excellent book.
It is, the full story, and I do that. I drive up West Dallas to Bagby, to the Heritage Society, quite frequently, obviously, and I think about that when I'm driving up that street and I look at the cemetery and I think about the men sort of hiding in there. And I think about that incredible history, and then keep driving.
Absolutely. Well, you know, I think it's unfortunate that a lot of people think Houston began with the space program.
Oh.
You know, I think a lot of people generally think that. Anything before that isn't really a part of our consciousness unless you're really interested. But the stories, and I hope our audience will agree, I find these stories absolutely fascinating.
I do too. I love it. I'm one of those native Houstonians, kind of rare, who just really celebrates our history and wants to save it, wants to talk about it. I want people to know about it. Yeah, we did.
Look, we're a town of characters.
Yeah.
I mean, from the Allen Brothers on, from Sam Houston on.
Yes, Jesse Jones, all kinds of
absolutely
people.
Now, if you take nothing else away from this program, let me speak to anyone who is a child in Houston or the Houston area, because every child in Houston is told that Ima Hogg had two sisters named Ura and Sheeza. It is not true, my friends. We must dispel this rumor. If you take nothing else from this show, please know there was no Ura and Sheeza Hogg.
That's right.
She was gorgeous, though.
I know.
A knockout.
And I believe, wasn't she named after James Hogg's sister or a family member? member? I mean, he didn't just come up with
this
name.
Wasn't just being mean.
No, I don't think that's the case.
She has brothers, and one of them fought in World War I, and that also was part of the impetus.
All right, I'll tell you what. Before the show's over, we'll try and find out who Ima Hogg was named after.
Yes.
Well, thank you. I hope we all take a little journey down these streets in the next few days. Now, Eric, though, you were not born in Houston and probably not subject to the "you're a and she's a hog" hoax. You seem to understand that certain businesses are integral to a true Houstonian's identity. I mean, in my mind, they're Whataburger,
right.
Bluebell, and H-E-B. Mm. Would you tell us your next story?
Yeah. First of all, Ginger, thank you. You're really brilliant and informative and
that's very
passionate
kind.
About this, and I think it's important for a city that has grown so quickly in the last 50-60 years. It's easy to just put layer on layer on layer and then forget the history. And
The Houston of today is extremely different from the Houston of 1900, of 1836.
Right.
It's dramatically different. And
imagine
it's easy
Houston
to
before air conditioning. Imagine going through your daily life without air conditioning and wearing those big wool coats.
Yes, that's when the population increased dramatically, by the way, air conditioning.
I was reading the history of River Oaks the other day.
Oh, yeah.
And River Oaks was the outskirts.
Yes.
In the 40s.
Yeah.
Like the part of the outskirts of Southwest Houston. And now it's, downtown more or less.
I know.
It's crazy. But,
it is.
Well, I would have to say that as a new Houstonian, thank you for receiving me into this conversation. Relatively new. I moved here in 2014. But for me, one of the very best things about moving to this city was discovering H-E-B. Can I get an amen?
Amen.
All right.
Love it.
So why anyone in this town would ever enter a Kroger or Randall's is beyond me. I'm sorry if they're one of the sponsors or something, but H-E-B is just amazing. But I will say my first experience at an H-E-B did not go so well. Now, nothing went wrong inside the store. That part was amazing. I was obviously blown away by the free samples, the expansive wine selection, and a little something I discovered that day called Topo Chico. And Topo Chico for me is like Windex for that old guy from My Big Fat Greek Wedding. Topo Chico just makes everything better. And so everything was going great. I checked out, paid surprisingly little for so many groceries, and I walked out the door to my car in the parking lot with my shopping cart full of perfectly packed paper bags. And as I approached my silver 2012 Chevy Traverse, I unlocked the rear gate with my remote key fob. And it wasn't the fancy kind that opens itself, so I had to go to the car and pull the gate open. And I started to put all of my groceries inside from the cart into the car. And I bought so much stuff that day that I could barely fit all of it in the car, but there must have been 15 to 20 bags in my cart. And finally, I loaded the last bag, and then I reached up to close the gate the back of my car. And it was at that moment that I realized that there were five pairs of eyes staring right at me. To my great surprise, five kids were sitting in my car. They were not my kids.
Oops.
I had never seen these children. The two kids in the front seats were the oldest. I think the one in the driver's seat was a teenager, but he looked so huge that his big body barely fit in the seat. He looked tough, too. I could see the tattoo sleeve on his right arm, and I've always been intimidated by big guys with tattoo sleeves for some reason. And the guy in the passenger seat, he was smaller, but he was no less intimidating because his eyes were two different colors. And I don't know if it's just me, but it seems like every evil villain in the movies has always got eyes with two different colors.
Oh, I have a coworker
colors,
with
except your coworker.
Two colors.
And so in the middle row, there were three younger kids, and they all had like little phones or tablets in their hands and earbuds in their ears. They didn't even hear me loading my groceries into the back of the car. They had just then realized that I was there. And for a half second, I had the most random thoughts. I thought things like, this explains why the groceries are so cheap. When you're inside, there's a bunch of kids stealing your car outside. But then I realized how ridiculous I was being, and these kids were probably just lost. And I was new to Houston, and people had told me when I moved to Texas that when you're near the border, like, coyotes will just drop off kids in random places. And maybe these were immigrant kids. They looked Hispanic, and I, that thought crossed my mind as a new Houstonian that didn't know any better. But if that's the case, what do you do? Do you call the cops? Like, do you call CPS, immigration? Like, my mind was racing. And I could see the kids starting to get agitated and anxious. And so I decided to be the adult here and take control of the situation. And so I looked at the big guy in the driver's seat, and I said in my most confident, manliest voice, "Can I help you, son?" And he looked back at me, and he said to me, in the sweetest, most innocent voice, "I'm sorry, sir. I think you might have the wrong car." And he pointed to the next row, where there was another silver Chevy Traverse. I took out my remote key fob and I pressed the button, and I hoped those lights wouldn't flash, knowing that they would, and they did. So with every ounce of dignity I could muster, I very calmly started lifting all my grocery bags out of their car and placing them back in my cart in a 20-second time span that felt eternal. And then the kid with the two different colored eyes, he even hopped out of the car and he came to help me with my groceries. That was the first time that I remember learning a very important lesson about this town. That lesson is, things aren't always what they seem. The kind of people you might have been raised to fear are the ones who are most likely to help you out in Houston. The kinds of places you were told to never go are the places you most want to be in Houston. Even the restaurants that look the worst and most dangerous serve the best food in Houston. A year and a half ago, I think we all learned this lesson all over again when Harvey dropped 50 plus inches of rain on us. And right away, my church and a bunch of other churches and organizations, we started putting together relief efforts, and immediately we had too many volunteers. We had more volunteers than we knew what to do with. And the same was true at George R. Brown and NRG and everywhere else in town. And no one in that time cared what ward you lived in, or what country you were born in, or what color your skin is, or what god you pray to. If you were underwater, we just wanted to help. You guys remember the Cajun Navy coming to our rescue?
Yes.
I don't remember them asking for anyone's documents or asking for anyone's sexual orientation or anything else. They just helped. And that's what people do, especially in Houston, in my experience. But the aftermath of that storm was maybe the most beautiful thing I've ever seen. It's surprising as that might sound. The truth is, every day in Houston brings a new surprise. But I don't know about y'all, there's no place I'd rather call home.
Oh, I think you just did a beautiful job of capturing the spirit of this city.
Thank you.
One thing I remember from the hurricane was several national anchors were mystified, and they would say, everywhere you go, people are volunteering, even if they lost their homes. And all my friends and I were like, is that unusual? I mean, it's how Houston is.
Right. Yes. I remember the picture that they posted outside NRG when all the volunteers were called to NRG, and Ed Emmett posted it, the county judge at the time. And he said, it was wrapping around the stadium. He said, these aren't the people in need. These are the people that have come to serve. And that's Houston. I think that's us at our best. It's not a perfect city, but I love it. I love living here.
I agree. I think you're speaking to two kindred spirits here. I fell in love with this city when I was 14, and that love has never diminished. And every story leads to five other stories.
Yes, that's true.
And let me settle from the best source I can find right now, which is Wikipedia, that I'm a hog. The best thought is that she was named after a character in her uncle's Civil War poem, The Fate of Marvin. It featured two young women named Ima and Leela. And
still seems mean. He could have chosen Lilo.
That's true.
I would agree. It says her brother came home every day with a bloody nose, and she said he was always defending my name.
Oh, that's nice.
And interestingly, she always wrote it so it was illegible. It would just scribble.
Well, I have to say, I'm so glad you told that little story about H-E-B, and you told the earlier story about your wife, and I just want to mention I got my husband at H-E-B.
Really?
I didn't know you could get spouses at H-E-B.
I did.
Shopping in the wrong section.
I'm pretty sure it was the pasta aisle.
Is he Italian?
Yeah, he is. He is. It was the big H-E-B in Austin, actually.
Wow, yes. I know that one. Well, friends, in December, Eric's first book, 40 Days of Doubt, Devotions for the Skeptic, was released and is available at Barnes & Noble, on Amazon, or a bookseller of your choice. And I can tell you I'm going to be checking it out.
Awesome. Thank you. Mm-hmm.
This Tuesday, March 26th, the Heritage Society will host the Houston Heritage Luncheon, Telling Houston Stories. James Haley, Texas historian and novelist, will be speaking about the connection of Charlotte Baldwin Allen and Sam Houston. This is a subject I'm actually interested in writing a play about right now. More about that in the near future. For more information on the luncheon, go to heritagesociety.org. I want to thank Ginger Burney and Eric Huffman for your stories and for enlightening us on a variety of Houston-centered topics. I look forward to having you both here again. Aside from the stories, I enjoyed you both a great deal. And hearing more stories from you in the future. That's a demand, not a request.
Thank you.
Sure,
now, friends, don't you.
You
dare move, because Lars is up next with a sweet mix of singer-songwriters on the Tennyson tapes. Make 90.1 a part of every day. And while you're driving home, turning in for the night, or just chilling out, join us each and every Thursday at 8 p.m. for So What's Your Story? And treasure what you hear. You keep loving great stories, and we will keep bringing them to you. This is Greg Audell, and along with the rest So What's Your Story team, we never want you to forget that it is absolutely never too late to live happily ever after. Peace, my friends.
In association with Young Audiences Houston and Kerr High School, KPFT presents the KPFT Art Gallery, featuring a wide array of photography and mixed media. KPFT's new art gallery is located in the station's front lobby. All art is available for purchase, with the proceeds benefiting both KPFT and college tuition funding. Contact partner@kpft.org. or visit the membership office during business hours for more information. So come check it out sometime. This is KPFT Houston.
ADAPT is a national grassroots organization that supports people with disabilities in their quest to live in their communities, not institutions. Each local ADAPT group develops its own style and selects its own actions. National networking provides information and strategies. A Houston ADAPT group is now organizing. If you're interested in peaceful protests,